Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Agella Reppes, and I represent the appellant, National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, PA. The resolution of this insurance coverage dispute is actually remarkably straightforward. It involves the basic question of, does the loss for which the port seeks coverage here fall within the basic scope of coverage of the umbrella excess policies? The type of loss for which the port seeks coverage here is for pre-suit claims, for expenses related to responding to administrative agency orders related to cleanup and remediation of environmental contamination and pollution. So when one compares the loss to the language of the insuring agreement, and here the language of the insuring agreement is clear. There is a duty to defend suits seeking damages, and there is a duty to indemnify damages. Now, the
I understand that, counsel, but I think your opposition suggests that endorsement 2 does not retain a subject 2 clause and thinks there's some significance in that. Would you like to address that for us?
Yes, Your Honor. So you're referring to the ultimate net loss limits of liability amended endorsement. And what the And what the port is focusing on in that endorsement is language that says this policy shall continue, enforces underlying insurance in the event of exhaustion. So the port is reading that language in order as a sort of follow form language to say that once primary insurance is exhausted, therefore the excess umbrella policies somehow transform into the primary policies and afford coverage on the exact same basis. And that is simply not true. All that this language is saying here in this endorsement is that once primary insurance exhausts, then excess coverage will pick up where primary leaves off. But that is a huge leap to say, oh, and therefore, by the way, it does so on precisely the same terms or somehow incorporates the broader insuring agreement of the underlying primary policies. That is absolutely
the district court was concerned about ambiguity in the policy. This endorsement does not contain subject to language, whereas the basic part of the insurance agreement does contain that subject to language. So you have, at the very outset of the policy, it indicates that it's subject to the limits of liability, exclusions, conditions, so forth, as set forth in the policy. But then you get to the endorsement, and that language is missing. And isn't it sort of basic insurance law that endorsements are tailored to the specifics of the policy? The language that includes the subject to language is sort of more like boilerplate. So isn't it particularly important that the endorsement does not have that subject to language?
It's not, actually, Your Honor. And this is the reason why, is because the port is trying to construe this as somehow the endorsement eliminates the language of the policy form, and it doesn't. There's no absolute repugnancy. And we know this from the Aerojet decision, which says only in the instances of absolute repugnancy does the endorsement control over the policy form. And here there's no absolute repugnancy. That's correct. The subject to language that you're referring to is not in the endorsement. However, it still says this policy, meaning the umbrella excess policies. And by definition, this policy means subject to the terms and conditions of this policy. It doesn't refer to the underlying primary policies. It doesn't say we incorporate the terms and conditions of another policy. That's not what it says. It's substantively identical. This policy is substantively identical to this policy subject to its terms and conditions. That's inherent in the meaning of this policy. And I'd also like to point out that the ultimate net loss endorsement does not actually say it deletes anything in the policy form. It says it amends the policy form. And as the port agrees, it simply supplements the policy form. So all these provisions can and should be read together. There is no repugnancy. So there's nothing that's been deleted by virtue of the endorsement. Everything ought to be read together.
Is there any other language in endorsement 2 that may be reasonably read as changing or altering the scope of the coverage?
Endorsement 2 does not alter the scope of the coverage. The insuring agreement says what it says. It is limited to suits seeking damages, and the duty to indemnify is limited to damages. Nothing in this endorsement says that it is altering or broadening the scope of the coverage to include pre-suit claims. There's nothing in here that says that or says that we're going to follow form to the primary policies. It does refer, what it really is intended to do is to simply say that when underlying primary insurance exhausts, will pick up. So that means that the excess coverage picks up and sits in the position and continues in force, but it doesn't say that we're going to do so on the same terms. And I'd like to point out that there's nothing incongruous about an excess policy that affords a narrower scope of coverage than the underlying primary policies. It depends on the language of the insuring agreement. It depends on what the policy says. So some excess policies provide exactly a coextensive scope of coverage. And the way this is accomplished is either through a straight follow form excess policy, or there could be an endorsement called a broad as primary endorsement on the excess policy. And that ensures that the excess coverage is as broad and it covers the same scope of risk as the underlying primary policy. But that's not invariably the case. You can also have excess policies that say they're follow form, except to the extent that the excess policy provides additional terms, conditions, and exclusions. And in fact, that's often the case. Follow form policies often narrow scope of coverage. So you could do it that way, or you could do it the way we have it here in the umbrella excess policies, which is that those policies have their own insuring agreement that provide a narrower scope of coverage. Keep in mind, this is a standard form insuring agreement, at least for pre-1986 policies, which is what we're talking about here. This was a standard form insuring agreement. It didn't cover claims. It didn't cover expenses. It didn't cover costs outside the context of a lawsuit. And in fact, the primary policies have the identical standard form language. And the only reason that they provide a broader scope of coverage is because there's an endorsement. There's a broad form property damage liability insurance endorsement that expands coverage to include both claims and suits. We don't have that endorsement on the umbrella excess policies. What the port would like you to believe is that somehow this trigger of coverage language by implication should be read or could be read or might be read as follow form language. And that's not the case. A follow form policy is express. It says we expressly hereby adopt the terms and conditions of the underlying policy. It's a few pages long. It's meant to adopt another policy's insuring agreement. And if you want a good example of what an actual follow form policy looks like, there is actually one in the record, because there's one within the port's tower of coverage. Under the 8283 tower of coverage, there's a Lexington policy that says this is a follow form excess liability policy. It expressly adopts the terms and conditions of the underlying policy. That's what an actual follow-form policy
is like. Counsel, the coverage provision, it does incorporate the definition of ultimate net loss is defined. I mean, there are cases, Ninth Circuit cases, which have indicated that in order to understand the scope of coverage, you have to look at that ultimate net loss definition. And here, the ultimate net loss definition, it does make reference to claims, settlements of claims, and so forth. The district court looked at that and said, I believe that there is an ambiguity about the scope of coverage because of the way in which that coverage provision incorporates this definition of ultimate net loss. I mean, how do you respond to that
claim of ambiguity? We have a trio of cases from both from the California Supreme Court and from the California Court of Appeal that address precisely this issue. So you have to look at it in context. It's not merely the fact that ultimate net loss includes the word claims. You have to look at its particular function and what it's doing. So in Powerline 2, ultimate net loss appeared in the insuring agreement, and that insuring agreement says we cover damages and expenses, all is more fully defined by ultimate net loss. And the court there said, because that's a very broad insuring agreement, that ultimate net loss was meant to expand the scope of coverage beyond suits, and it also had that word expenses. We don't have that here. And in fact, the case on point for that is the County of San Diego and also CDM Investors. And CDM Investors, which is directly on point, the ultimate net loss term was found in the insuring agreement, and the court said, well, you have to look at what it's doing, not just where it's located within the policy. It doesn't purport to expand the scope of coverage. It's simply identifying what amount the insurer will indemnify once the policy has been triggered. So if there are expenses that have matured into damages, yeah, we'll pay those. We'll indemnify those. But that is not an independent expansion of the insuring agreement. That is not how ultimate net loss functions within the context of this particular insuring agreement, as was the case in CDM Investors.
Do I have to interpret this policy and find it to be clear and unambiguous in order for you to win in this particular case?
Well, it is clear and unambiguous. There is simply no other...
I didn't ask you that. What if I find it isn't? I mean, there's no question it's challenging to piece together, and there's no question that a layperson inexperienced in reading it might have a difficult time in doing it.
Well, the standard is not simply, is it difficult for a layperson to piece together? The insuring agreement defines the basic scope of coverage, and that is clear. The port doesn't even really take issue with it because it says what it says.
Just to follow up Judge Smith's question, I mean, this is on the aggregate limit of liability question. I mean, I'm looking at endorsement two, and you have that phrase separately in respect of products liability and respect of personal injury by occupational disease sustained by any employees of the insured. Now, I mean, I would not call that artful drafting. It's a little hard to figure out exactly what that means. I mean, I know what you think ultimately it means, but can you put in plain terms what that phrase is?
Sure. There? Sure. And we have the aid here of the California Court of Appeal decision in Garamendi, which considered exactly this language. And the court, all this is doing is it's referring, if you look at the deck page, item 3B, it says C or per endorsement 2. So it's referring you to this endorsement to fill in additional details about what the limit is. So what it's filling in here is the amount of the per occurrence limit. And it also says in the aggregate. So it's giving you the aggregate limit. That's the general aggregate limit. And then the language, comma, separately in respect of products liability and occupational disease means there are also separate aggregate limits for these particular types of losses. So that doesn't eliminate the general aggregate limit. It adds to it.
Okay, so the $20 million applies to those particular separate risks for product personal injuries, result of product liability, and occupational disease. Is that how it should be read?
In addition, there are additional separate limits, but that doesn't negate the fact that there's also a general aggregate limit in the same amount, and Garamendi construed the same language and reached the identical conclusion. Separately does not mean only. It means in addition to, not only. And I see that my time is running out, so with that, I will conclude with asking the court to reverse the judgment and enter judgment in favor of National Union in the manner that we've requested in our opening brief. Thank you.
All right. With that, given that Judge Rawlinson is again not on the video, but she's listening by telephone, let us go with the respondent or with the appellee plaintiff.
Thank you, Your Honor. Robert Horkovich, I appreciate your time this morning on behalf of the San Diego Unified Port District. The key issue in this case determines whether the San Diego Unified Port District gets the ability to tap its historic liability insurance coverage for its historic environmental liabilities imposed on the port, not because of its actions, but because of events that others took decades ago. AIG challenges two district court decisions in the port's favor regarding two aspects of AIG's obligations, one, the scope, and two, the amount. We respectfully ask this court to affirm the district court's orders. One of the things...
Well, let's get right at it.
Yes, sir.
What is the specific language in the umbrella or excess policies that alter the scope of coverage from suits and damages?
Well, two things, Your Honor. First of all, in the record, an example on the insuring agreement in the record at 299, there's language that says, this insuring agreement shall also apply to occurrences not covered by the underlying insurance due to exhaustion of any aggregate.
That's correct. That's in the preamble, right? That's in the preamble of the duty to defend. But doesn't that language just mean that this insuring agreement shall apply? That's the language. Just indicate that when excess coverage is triggered, it will be governed by this insurance agreement and therefore will be limited coverage for suits and damages.
Your Honor has many duties and you're very, very busy. But one of the things, unfortunately, that AIG has put you in a position in here is being an underwriter for AIG. That's not what the policy says. The AIG underwriter...
Well, I'm having a tough time understanding why it isn't what the policy says.
Because it says, Your Honor, this insuring agreement shall also apply to occurrences. It says nothing about trigger. This shall also apply to occurrences not covered by the underlying insurance because of exhaustion of the aggregate limits by reason of loss pay they're under. So what it says is that when the underlying primary policy, which counsel for AIG readily concedes covered claims, when that underlying insurance is paid out and that insurance is no longer available, this insuring agreement applies to those occurrences. Now, then we move on. That's one. Then we move on to the endorsement two that you're referring to. We move on to page 3.
Counsel, before you go to the endorsement, I mean, just look at the coverage provision.
Yes, sir.
And look at the 2A under the defense provision. I mean, it seems to me that language is very clear that the coverage here only relates to damages. And in fact, when the coverage provision refers to the portion of the ultimate net loss provision, it's very careful to say that it's only that portion of the definition of ultimate net loss that relates to damages that is covered. And then in addition to that, and then you can respond to both of these if you would please, the defense provision talks about they have an obligation to defend any suit, but with respect to a claim, they have the right to, but they're not obligated to. So you look at those two provisions, it seems to me they're all about damages and not at all about claims.
Well, I hear what Your Honor is saying, but it does not say that in the provision saying that this applies to occurrences not covered by underlying insurance due to exhaustion. They don't put ultimate at loss in there. And then if I may proceed to the endorsement, which, as Your Honor is correct, under Aerojet, the endorsements take precedence over the coverage. Under Aerojet, at page 307 of the record, It says, in the event a reduction or exhaustion of the aggregate limits of the underlying insurance by reasons of losses paid thereunder. Two, in the event of exhaustion, continue in force as underlying insurance. Not, as AIG argues, we pick up from where underlying insurance drops off. It expressly states this continues in force as underlying insurance.
And then why doesn't that language simply speak to when the excess coverage is triggered?
Because it says it's continuing as excess, as underlying insurance. It doesn't
That just means that's when the excess coverage is triggered.
Well, that would have been a good thing for the AIG underwriters to put in. But they say it continues
as
the underlying insurance. Okay. That would have been, you know, your honors have talked about inartful drafting. That's not your honor's fault. That's not the port's fault. That is what AIG did. Now, further, if you take a look at the language that supplements, and this is set out in our brief at pages 33 and 34, that endorsement takes out language which clarifies that. In what language is being taken out? And the language that's being taken out, and this is said, when you're comparing the language of the record at 300 to the language of the record at 307, the language that's being taken out is the language that says, subject to its terms and conditions and limits of liability, as stated in items 3A and 3B of the declarations. So what they're removing, is saying, this policy is subject to its own terms and conditions. That language that appears on 300 is being amended and deleted by AIG when stating that it's continuing in force as the underlying.
Well, but if you're really talking about the scope of the coverage, which seems to me where you are now, I mean, if this expands the scope of the coverage to include claims, then wouldn't it render the coverage and the duty to defend the provisions of the base policy, frankly, superfluous?
There's perfectly permissible for an excess umbrella policy to supplement coverage in the underlying policy. And we see that in this policy through the following form endorsements, where they say we follow form to this, we follow form to that, and in pages 312, 330, and so on, they follow form, and even they follow form to certain underlying coverages. So it's perfectly consistent.
What do those coverages have to do with coverage for property damage resulting from environmental contamination? Those follow form endorsements seem to be a very discrete issue, not having anything to do with the coverage issue we're talking about here.
No, that's exactly correct, Judge Lippis, but they prove that this policy incorporates in certain instances, they follow form and adopt language they adopt in other places, underlying policy definitions. It's perfectly consistent for a excess umbrella policy to adopt coverages underlying policy.
I guess I'm just repeating Judge Smith's question, but why, if this is a following form policy, why would they take such care to define coverage in the way that they do as part of the basic insuring agreement provision? That seems a completely unnecessary exercise if this is just a following form policy.
Well, they did both, Your Honor, and an umbrella can include broader coverage than the underlying primary.
Sure, it can be broader or narrower, and it depends about how they define the coverage in the umbrella excess policy.
Yes, Your Honor. And here they're saying they're continuing in force as the underlying insurance. Now, one very important point, Your Honor, is the standard here. And obviously, this is de novo for Your Honors as a matter of law. But the core question in interpreting this is whether the port's interpretation is a reasonable interpretation, not as whether it's the most representation or the only reasonable interpretation. You just have to have the reasonable interpretation. And AIG argues, well, it's more reasonable to conclude this, or a more reasonable explanation is this. That's not the standard. The standard
all you're suggesting with this argument is that there is not a clear and unambiguous interpretation of this language, and therefore you can come up with an interpretation that's okay. Now, that's why I asked her the question about what was the language, is it having trouble? I mean, if I find this to be clear and unambiguous, and it is the same as what your opponents suggest the language says, I won't need to talk about your reasonable interpretation at all. It'll be wrong. It's not clear and unambiguously the way you want it to be. Yeah, I've lost your voice. Did you turn off your mic? I can't hear you.
Mr. Horkovich, can you hear me? Mr. Horkovich, Judge, perhaps if you hold up your hand in the stop sign. Mr. Horkovich, we cannot hear you. Mr. Horkovich?
Counselor.
Judge, I'll try to give him on the phone.
Counselor,
we had him back for just a moment there, Mr. Horkovich. We could hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Now we can. Approximately the last 3 minutes,
you better go back to your argument you were making, because I didn't hear any of it.
Thank you, Your Honor. may it please the court. The question is whether or not this is a reasonable interpretation. We are not advocating that this is that this language is clear and unambiguous. Far from it. That's not what we're arguing. We're saying that a reasonable interpretation, and this is what the district court found, and we asked the court to affirm, that a reasonable interpretation is that when it says that it's continuing in force as underlying insurance, that it's providing the same coverage that the underlying insurance provides. AIG does not contest that it provides coverage for claims. And when it deleted the provision that says that it's subject to its terms, conditions, and limits, as stated in the declaration page, and when it says that, it meant that it deleted it, and that you look toward the scope of the coverage, you look toward what's in the underlying policy. And that's consistent with the other aspects of the policy. And that's what the district court held. We ask your honors to affirm that. It's not that we are saying that that the language is clear and unambiguous. We're not saying that. We're not saying that we have.
Well, we know that. We know that, counselor. We're saying that the only reason we would even think about your reasonable interpretation is if we find it's ambiguous policy. If we don't find it's ambiguous, if we find it's clear and unambiguous, what you think it means makes no difference.
That's true. If you find it's clear and unambiguous.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's all
I
was trying to say.
If you find that it's clear and unambiguous.
Do you want to say something about your second point?
I would like
about
to say
something. About the aggregate limit?
If I might just first. Yes, Your Honor. But I first might say something.
Because you've only got 225 left.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to say something about Garamendi. And the other case that she cited first. In Garamendi, there was extensive language in that policy. It was different policy language, different factual circumstances. The policyholder, the court in Garamendi held in favor of maximizing coverage. The language was extensive in Garamendi. There were paragraphs and paragraphs in Garamendi that went on that I don't have time to go into, but that cited in our briefs at 43, 44, paragraphs after paragraphs that are not in our language. And the court of appeal.
Counsel, excuse me, your time is limited. I'd like you to respond.
Okay.
I have this concern. It'd be helpful for you to know what my concern is. And it's this. This is on this aggregate general liability question.
Yes, sir.
In the declaration page, in item 3B, there's a specific reference to endorsement 2. And it begins by saying, in the aggregate for the policy period of each annual period, indicating that you look to that endorsement 2 to determine what that aggregate is. I then find it very difficult to understand how, having been told in the declaration page that you look to endorsement 2 to determine what that aggregate is, that you then read that language in endorsement 2 to eliminate any general aggregate liability limitation. I don't know how you can reconcile that argument with what the declaration tells you the purpose of endorsement 2 is. You look to it to find out what that aggregate is. You say endorsement 2 eliminates any limit. I don't know how you can make that argument.
Well, by looking at page 306, the amendment stated, and the amendments take precedence, the amendment states, the amendment states that it's declarations each annual period during the currency of this policy. During the currency of this policy, separately in respect to products liability and in respect to personal injury by occupational disease, by employment or insured. There is no, as the district court found, there is no express general aggregate. Counsel said that there's an express general aggregate stated, but there's not an express general aggregate stated. There's an aggregate stated for products and an aggregate stated for occupational disease. There's no general aggregate stated, and that's on in page 306 of the record. What I was trying to say about Garamendi, in looking at this blank...
Well, but just a minute. Your time's up. I think we know what your argument is about Garamendi. We've heard it before. We've read about it. And if you've answered my colleague's question, then I think your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor, for your time today.
Thank you.
Your Honor,
we'll go back
I know
to you. You have...
Excuse me, Your Honor. I know I'm. Could I possibly have 1 minute for rebuttal?
Well, I didn't give him any extra time, really. I'll give you 1 minute. Then I'll have to give him a minute. You know that. Come on.
Well, we're the appellant, so typically you get the rebuttal the last word. So I'll beg Your
All
Honor.
All right, I'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Frankly, that is Judge Rawlinson's normal approach to give you 1 minute. So I'll give it
Thank
to you.
Very,
My approach
you very
is
much.
When your time's up, it's up. Go ahead.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I want to make just two very quick points in response to what Mr. Horkovich said. Your Honors have hit the nail on the head when you said, why on earth, if this was intended to be a follow-form policy and to adopt and incorporate the terms of the primary policy, why on earth would this excess umbrella policies, why would they have their own insuring agreement, their own terms and conditions? It renders the entire policy superfluous, and that is contrary to all rules of contract construction. It erases the most fundamental aspect of the policies, which is the insuring agreement. The court's interpretation is not reasonable. The district court's interpretation is not reasonable exactly for this reason. It's not simply any interpretation of which the court is able to conceive. And for these reasons,
thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We will submit case 1955409 has been argued and now submitted. Thank you very much, counsel, for your good arguments. We really appreciated it. It's great to have you, and we're sorry we have to do it under these conditions. we hope that the port found it okay, because he went on for quite a while and we couldn't hear him. We let him go back and give it to us again. So we appreciate both of you. Thank you very much.